Hello and welcome. I'm Fred Lublin. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled Right Patient, Right Treatment, Right Time, Utilizing Early High Efficacy Therapies to Improve Outcomes in Relapsing Remitting MS. Today's activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians worldwide. Today's CME CE activity is also eligible for ABIM MOC points. Actively participate in today's program, and once you complete today's program, be sure to provide your ABIM ID and birth date in the evaluation, and CME offers will submit your MOC points. As I mentioned, I'm Dr. Fred Lublin. I'm the Saunders Family Professor of Neurology and Director of the Corinne Goldsmith Dickinson Center for Multiple Sclerosis at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. I'm looking forward to our discussion today, which will focus on strategies for the diagnosis and treatment of patients with relapsing remitting MS. Let me introduce our faculty who are joining me. First, let me welcome Dr. Joseph Berger. Dr. Berger is Professor of Neurology and the Associate Chief of the Multiple Sclerosis Division at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Fred.
Also, let me introduce Dr. Ann Cross. Dr. Cross is Professor of Neurology and also holds the Manny and Rosalind Rosenthal and the John L. Trotter Multiple Sclerosis Center Chair in Neuroimmunology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome, Ann.
Thanks, Fred.
Now, let me start with our first learning objective, which is select patients with RRMS who are likely to benefit from early treatment with high-efficacy disease-modifying treatments. Our second learning objective is to develop tailored treatment approaches based on individual patient characteristics. And our third objective is to apply the latest clinical data on approved and emerging disease-modifying therapies in monitoring and treatment response, safety, and tolerability. So let's start with our first patient case. Here's Julie, a 22-year-old white female with no significant prior medical history. She has a sudden onset of blurred vision in the right eye and pain in that eye on movement. She also complains of fatigue and innervation in warm weather, which has been present for over a year. She denies Laramide symptom, vertigo, diplopia, sphincter dysfunction, paresthesia or numbness, weakness or imbalance. So let me get our audience involved. The question is on your screen and you can choose your response to our first question. We're not going to show you the results just yet, but please put your answers in and I'll share the results with you a little later on. Okay, so Joe, let's start. Would you discuss with us the different phenotypes of MS?
Sure. Currently, we divide MS into several phenotypes. One is the clinically isolated syndrome, which is when the patient first presents with their initial symptom, as would be the case with our patient presenting here. She presents with optic neuritis. She doesn't tell you that she has any other definable lesions somewhere in the central nervous system, although your antenna are raised because she comments on fatigue that's been present for a year, a very common manifestation with early MS. And she also comments on a lack of energy when she's exposed to heat, although many people complain of that. There's radiologically isolated syndrome, which is that patient who comes in having had migraine headaches or some other reason for having had an MRI performed and has disease in their brain that was not clinically apparent otherwise. And their criteria for establishing the diagnosis of radiologically isolated syndrome. Remitting and relapsing multiple sclerosis is the form that we see most commonly. Those individuals diagnosed with MS, it's about 85%, whereas 15%, 10 to 15% present initially with what's called primary progressive disease. Now, relapsing remitting disease is one in which the individual should have a second event. And that event may be manifest clinically or in some other way, which we'll talk about in a little while. With primary progressive disease, a form of the illness that we see generally in an older population, the illness slowly progresses over a period of time and can be quite difficult to diagnose if you don't consider it. And then secondary progressive MS is that form of the illness that many people advance to after a decade or more of the disease, when the disease takes on a life of its own and moves from a relapsing remitting phase to one in which there's progression. Now, that progression can sometimes have superimposed on it relapses. So it is a form of the illness in which one can still see relapses superimposed on the progression.
So we're focusing on relapsing remitting MS today. Why don't you take us through the diagnostic criteria?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you should have two, if you're going to diagnose the disease clinically, as you see on the slide, you should have two or more clinical attacks with clinical evidence of two or more lesions, that is, on your physical examination. And recall, the neurologists are still the discipline that walks around with the black bag and lays hands on patients, making telemedicine very difficult. So you should have some objective evidence on your physical examination, or alternatively, evidence of one lesion with a prior attack involving a lesion in a distinct anatomic location. If you have that, you have no further evidence that's needed. You don't have to do an MRI. You don't have to do a lumbar puncture, though you would do the MRI because it informs you about other things such as prognosis, which we will talk about later during the course. Or you have a patient with a history of two or more attacks with clinical evidence of only one lesion. In that instance, you want evidence on MRI of hyperintense signal abnormalities, or wait and see if the patient develops another clinical attack. You know, the Dutch have a proverb which says, an ounce of patience is worth a pound of brains. Sometimes it takes a while to feel comfortable with the diagnosis. So there are patients that come to you who you suspect multiple sclerosis, but you have a very difficult time fully feeling comfortable with the diagnosis because there's insufficient evidence either radiographically or in spinal fluid examination, and one has to simply follow them clinically. On this slide, you'll see there's been a change in the recent past with the update of the McDonald criteria to include oligoclonal bands. So as indicated on this slide, if you have evidence of dissemination in space and dissemination in time based on your clinical findings in MRI, you can establish the diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. If you have evidence of isolation in space and an MRI, either clinically or by MRI, but you don't have it in time, you'd need a second event, either clinically or by MRI, or you'd need the spinal fluid findings of oligoclonal bands, which will now substitute for your dissemination in time. If you have a clinically isolated syndrome in an MRI without dissemination in space, you need to have a second event or a new MRI finding to give you that dissemination in both space and time in order to call it multiple sclerosis.
Thanks, Joe. So, Anne, why don't you take us through the MRI criteria?
So, Fred, as you know, the MRI has become increasingly important in making the diagnosis of MS. And I would start out by saying that if you have a patient that you think might have MS and you do good quality MRIs of the brain and the spinal cord with at least a 1.5 Tesla scanner and axial scans of 3 millimeters with no gaps and you see no lesions, then I would highly question the diagnosis. But that said, the newest McDonald criteria allow dissemination in space with only two lesions, one at least in each of at least two of four locations, periventricular, cortical or juxtacortical, infratentorial, and spinal cord, which are all illustrated here. And I did want to point out that people sometimes get confused about periventricular and particularly juxtacortical lesions. Periventricular means a lesion that is next to the ventricle with no intervening white matter. And the same goes for juxtacortical. This is not a subcortical lesion. This is a juxtacortical lesion with no intervening white matter. And that sometimes is helpful in separating out vascular lesions or lesions of other etiologies from MS. And the other thing I wanted to point out about these criteria is that at least this latest rendition of the McDonald criteria was very explicit about the fact that these criteria are to be applied or should be applied in people who have a clinically isolated typical of demyelination syndrome. So something like optic neuritis or a brainstem syndrome with intranuclear ophthalmoplegia or a partial transverse myelitis, those types of things, not just some kind of neurological manifestation that might not be typical of demyelination. So, because we don't want to have too many misdiagnoses either.
And misdiagnosis has been an issue. So here are the MRI findings for Julie. Her exam shows a visual acuity is 20/20 on the left and 20/30 on the right with cohort desaturation in the right eye. Spinal fluid had a normal cell count, normal protein, but 8 unique oligoclonal bands. Alternate diagnoses for optic neuritis were ruled out. And here we see her MRI. She has several hyperintense lesions, T2 lesions. None of these are contrast enhancing and none are in the infratentorial compartment. While not seen on this slide, there was enhancement of the right optic nerve and there were no spinal cord lesions. So let me go back to our audience now. And you see the question here. Okay, so we have before and after results, before in blue, after in green. And so we've got the majority of people now have gone for multiple sclerosis first episode, whereas majority were in the insufficient data, I don't know, before this. So Joe and Ann, what do you think about this?
So this is a patient that comes from my clinic, and I felt quite comfortable seeing the MRI and the spinal fluid results and labeling her with the optic neuritis being the first episode of multiple sclerosis that she had. She fulfills criteria for dissemination in time with the oligoclonal bands. She's had one clinical event, but she certainly has multiple lesions, several of which are quite typical for multiple sclerosis, particularly those exhibit with Dawson's finger appearance to them on the MRI. So I would have labeled her and had multiple sclerosis first episode.
And
so technically she's still clinically isolated syndrome because she hasn't met all the dissemination in space criteria, but because she has periventricular lesions but doesn't have infratentorial or spinal cord or juxtacortical, correct?
So my argument would be, you're correct about that, but my argument would be that that's the problem with the criteria that we have, not with the disease that she has.
And so I was going to say, Joe, that I think she has MS too. I mean, her lesions look like MS, she smells like MS. And in fact, there was a lot of argument in those criteria about whether to put in lesions in the optic nerve or not. And it was ultimately decided by the group who came up with those criteria not to include optic nerve.
And so you're both right, because we didn't give the localization of the supertentorial lesions. And given that there were 7, I will make it easy and say, well, one of them was periventricular and at least one of them was juxtacortical.
All right, Fred, let me just argue this. She has contrast enhancement in the optic nerve and 7, we know from that she had multiple other lesions in her brain of different age. So she's got dissemination in time on an MRI, but they didn't include optic nerve.
Yeah, we don't have time to go into that tonight, but there were some very good reasons why optic nerve was not included, although there are arguments on both sides. So let's go on to the next question we have. Okay, so majority said good, and then the rest variable, I don't know. So, okay, these are good. So Anne, give us an idea of the predictors of poor prognosis in MS.
Well, Fred, thanks for asking. This is, even here in 2020, I would say that we do not have a crystal ball to say what's going to happen to somebody, but we have a lot of statistical prognostic factors that have to be sort of integrated into the equation. It's but it's not a simple matter of like counting up all the factors and the good prognostic factors. So that said, poor prognostic factors include being male, she's not male, being not of European descent, she is of European descent, and then a number of other modifiable environmental factors like vitamin D status. Clinical factors include being relapsing remitting and having a good recovery, and her visual acuity was pretty good the last time you mentioned it, and so that would be a good recovery, and she hasn't had a lot of relapses, another good clinical prognosticator, and she didn't have polysymptomatic onset, which means like in addition to her optic neuritis, she also had an INO or something like that. So she didn't have more than one thing going on, and she doesn't apparently have any cognitive deficits. All of those are good things for her. She doesn't have what most of us would consider a high number of T2-weighted lesions, and she doesn't appear to have a lot of brain atrophy, though we haven't really commented on that. Then there are a lot of biomarkers that are out there in the literature, most of which are not validated. Roberta Magliozzi and I did a review of these, just the non-MRI biomarkers about a year ago in MS Journal. And really the only ones that are have held up are the numbers and presence of both IgG and IgM oligoclonal bands. The higher numbers of IgG oligoclonal bands, the worse the patient is. And I can't really tell you what 8 would mean. In terms of other things that have been proposed, like neurofilament light chain in the spinal fluid, that does have some prognostic significance, but it's not clinically available to most people. And the same would go for chitinase like one in the spinal fluid, also known as YKL40. So there are a number of things. She tends to have a lot of good prognostic factors, or at least she lacks the poor prognostic factors. So I'm hopeful she'll do well.
Okay, good. So before we go on to the next question, I want to take up a question that came up. And so someone in the audience asked an interesting question, and that is, would a lesion in the cortical area and a second lesion in the juxtacortical region count for DIS? I want to confirm cortical and juxtacortical are viewed independently or not.
According to the criteria, they are not viewed independently. They are one thing. I don't know if that was a point of discussion during their meeting, but they are listed together, just like infratentorial is listed as one place and spinal cord is listed as one place. So at least my read of the criteria is that you have to have at least two lesions, and they have to be in, those two lesions have to be in two of those categories of space, like periventricular versus spinal cord.
Yeah, that's the intention of the criteria. I agree. Okay, so let's go back to Julie. The yeses have it, which is good, because now let's go on to the follow-up question. Okay, Joe, would you go through the different categories of DMTs that we use for management of MS, the pros and cons of each?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the three broad categories are defined as immunomodulators, cell trafficking inhibition agents, and cell depleting therapies. And that might have been a confusing question to some people because they might not have known what drug that they would have preferred, what category it fit in. So the immunomodulators are interferon beta, of which there are several, glutaramer acetate, dimethyl fumarate, and teriflunomide. These are regarded, for the most part, as quite safe. We have a long-term experience, certainly with the interferons and with Copaxone, and they are regarded as having modest efficacy. Now, when I say that, I say it hesitatingly because there's some people that respond beautifully to these drugs and do exceptionally well. Of course, you have to bear in mind that there are people that have been pathologically demonstrated to take MS to the grave with them and not even known they've had it. So there's a bell-shaped curve in terms of how people respond to their illness and how they respond to these drugs. The cell trafficking agents, cell trafficking inhibition agents are natalizumab, fingolimod, siponimod, and ozanimod, which are the S1P receptor modulators. and ponesimod, which should be coming out. The pros are it has greater efficacy. The onset of action is quick, certainly very quick with natalizumab, and for the most part, they appear to be well tolerated. They do carry a risk of opportunistic infection. The natalizumab and fingolimod have both been associated with PML, though natalizumab orders of magnitude higher than fingolimod. And there are other opportunistic infections like cryptococcal meningitis that has been seen. The cells are still in the body. Rebound disease is seen when you stop these drugs. Probably has to do with the onset of action, the quick onset of action. Well, you take them off and the action returns. And the long-term safety with these drugs remains unclear, though my sense is that they're going to be relatively well tolerated over long periods of time. And then lastly, you have the cell depleting agents, which include alemtuzumab, cladribine, and the anti-CD20s like ocrelizumab and rituximab, which are used in some countries in place of ocrelizumab. Ofatumumab, a drug that should come out in the not too distant future, and of course, bone marrow transplantation. And these are depleting, they deplete the disease-causing cells. There's no rebound disease observed with these particular therapies, but they too have a risk of opportunistic infections, particularly with alemtuzumab, and one sees secondary autoimmune disease, again, particularly with alemtuzumab. And they're, in some instances, a bit more cumbersome to use, but that's not entirely true. As you know, drugs like ocrelizumab are ones that can be administered at 6-month intervals, though the patient has to go to an infusion suite in order to have it infused. So those are the three broad classes of drugs and a way to think about them.
So let's take a closer look, Joe, at the current high efficacy agents.
Yeah, so in looking at these high efficacy agents, and here we have cladribine, fingolimod, alemtuzumab, and natalizumab. The anti-CD20 should be up there as well, but we'll talk about them in a second. You see that they have a pretty significant ability to reduce relapse rates. So they will lower relapse rates by more than 50%, each and every one of them, at least when compared to placebo, and alemtuzumab when compared to an active comparator in interferon beta. They all have a modest effect on disability progression, so about a third to 40% in terms of reducing future disability. And they have, in some instances, a pretty profound effect on reducing T2 lesions. And of course, there are safety concerns with them. You certainly wouldn't start a cladribine patient if they had HIV or active chronic infections. Those have to be treated before you would initiate it. You'd never start an HIV patient on cladribine because of the associated lymphopenia. With fingolimod, we have concerns about cardiac effects, in particular the slowing of heart rate. That's why they have that first dose observation built into the drug initiation. There's macular edema, bronchial asthma, and a variety of other concerns that one sees, though by and large a very well tolerated drug. Alemtuzumab, the biggest concern we have with it, because we see it with a fairly high frequency, are autoimmune disorders, in particular autoimmune thyroid disease, which can occur in up to a third of the patients that you treat with alemtuzumab. And with natalizumab, the biggest concern we have, of course, is progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, although other problems have been reported with it. They're fortunately fairly uncommon. But PML is a huge concern. There's a risk mitigation strategy for PML that must be followed, in which those individuals who are JC virus antibody positive, who've been on the drug for more than 2 years, should be taken off the drug because the risk of developing PML in that population is just too high, at least in my opinion. I know that there are individuals that remain on it because they like the drug, and there are people that believe that giving it an extended dosing intervals will reduce the risk of PML, but it's not zero. So there, I would consider looking at alternatives in that particular population.
So now, Anne, let's look at some more recently approved therapies, and we'll start with the oldest of the recently approved, which would be ocrelizumab.
Thanks, Fred. Ocrelizumab, I think, was approved in March of 2017 and was studied in two phase three trials, OPERA 1 and OPERA 2, which had similar numbers of patients in them and assured us all they had very similar results. The drug was given, it's given as 600 milligrams as an infusion every 6 months, although the first dose is cut in half and given 2 weeks apart. But in this study, the drug was compared not to placebo, but to interferon beta-1A, 44 micrograms, 3 times a week. And in both these trials, a close to 50% reduction in annualized relapse rate versus the active comparator was seen in those people who were on ocrelizumab. And there also was about a 40% reduction in disability progression seen in those studies. And there was a statistically significant increase in disability improvement in the patients on ocrelizumab in those studies. In addition, there were really striking effects on MRI activity to the note of in the 90% reduction of gadolinium enhanced lesions in the ocrelizumab group compared to beta interferon. But this drug is not without its potential risks and side effects. Infusion reactions are common, but in addition, there's risk of upper respiratory infections, and there is a seeming risk of increased cancer, particularly invasive ductal breast cancer and other types of cancers compared to the interferon beta group, and also in another study in primary progressive MS. So a very effective drug for relapsing MS, even compared to an active comparator, but not without some risks.
Okay, now let's move on to the newest approved agent for relapsing forms of MS, ozanimod.
So ozanimod was just approved not too long ago, and this is an oral agent, somewhat similar to fingolimod, but also different. It's in that category of sphingosine 1-phosphate receptor modulators, like fingolimod and like siponimod. It's more selective than fingolimod, affecting just mainly the receptors 1 and 5. And it was studied in two studies that found a reduction in relapse rate compared to beta interferon of not quite 50% in annualized relapse rate, and a greater than 50% reduction in gadolinium enhancing lesions compared to beta interferon 1A. Two doses were studied in the RADIANT study, but we use mostly the higher dose, which is 0.92 milligrams or 1 milligram per day orally. And ozanimod has the same risks that were discussed by Joe regarding fingolimod. There are concerns about bradycardia, and lymphopenia occurs. That will occur in all patients who actually take it. Macular edema is of some concern. There are several drugs that you shouldn't take along with this or fingolimod or siponimod. But all in all, relatively safe drug and very effective. And it does not require a first dose observation. People up titrate this drug over about a week and make it up to the dose that's recommended of 0.92 or basically 1 milligram per day.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if you could say that the lymphopenia, though, is an adverse effect. It really is to be anticipated with any of the S1P modulators. And at least the data from fingolimod indicates that there's no correlation, at least none that could be found, between opportunistic infections or any infection and the presence of the lymphopenia. So you will see profound lymphopenia in these people, sometimes AIDS-like lymphopenia, but it doesn't seem to have an adverse effect on them in terms of putting them at increased risk for infection. And it probably has something to do with the fact that the lymphocytes are trapped in the lymph nodes, but there's still some circulation of cells that are effective in suppressing these infections. So,
thanks for bringing that up, Joe, because I mean, I certainly agree with you. The lymphopenia is part of the mechanism of action of the drug. And in fact, you can almost use it to make sure your patient is taking their medications. Right. If they aren't lymphopenic, then you are concerned that they're not taking it. And one nice thing about this drug is that it doesn't kill off your old immunity. It's all still there, just stuck in the lymph nodes, more or less.
Okay, good. So emerging agents, emerging very soon. Joe, tell us a little bit about ofatumumab.
Yeah, so this is a drug that is an anti-CD20 like ocrelizumab. There have been two studies looking at it, Asclepios 1 and 2. Large numbers of patients, nearly 1,000 in each of these studies. And one of the remarkable things is how rapidly this drug works. So within about a month's time, they saw this tremendous reduction in gadolinium-enhancing lesions. So it was 97% in one study and 93% in the other study. And this was against an active comparator. This was against teriflunomide. And there was also a very significant reduction in annualized relapse rate, greater than 50% in both the studies when compared to an active comparator, namely teriflunomide. And again, it proved to be safe and extremely well tolerated. So this is a drug that I think there's some excitement in the community about. This is a drug that's administered by injection, and the patient could administer it themselves. So there's a convenience for them. They don't have to go to an infusion suite now to get their anti-CD20. And it probably decreases the expense. It certainly decreases the infusion expense associated with receiving ocrelizumab.
Okay, so and now we're going to get to discussion of the factors that one could consider when picking a therapy. And as you can see, there are many that have to keep in mind. And this is actually an important slide to come up now because there's a number of questions that are already in the queue related to when to start treatment and how you pick therapy and such. So Joe, why don't you take us through this?
So I'm giving you my philosophy, and my philosophy is that the earlier you treat people, the better off they are. That's been demonstrated since the BENEFIT trial with interferon beta 1b. And I like to keep the disease well suppressed. I tell the patient, let me worry about your disease. I want to be the one worrying about it, and I don't want them to have any activity if we could avoid it. So that's what's in the back of my mind as the physician. Of course, the patient is part of this equation, and they have to realize that there are risks and benefits with anything that one undertakes. So this slide very nicely portrays the type of issues that one deals with, and that is, Anne mentioned earlier the prognostic features. They go into this calculation as to what drug to select. Obviously, if you have somebody who has rather benign disease, you might want to select a drug that is more of an immunomodulator, one that has a long safety record. If the patient's considering pregnancy, that's another issue. The issues of monitoring are of concern. There are people that you know may not be taking the drug that you give them, or may not come back to have their laboratory studies tested. And that can be a huge concern with certain drugs like Lemtrada, or alemtuzumab, where you need to monitor them periodically. So safety, tolerability, convenience, monitoring, pregnancy issues, cost, fighting with the insurance companies is an issue, and sometimes it simply becomes overwhelming. The patient preference, they might not want to inject themselves and be adamant about it. Your experience with the drug plays a role in it, and the mechanism of action of the drug. So all of this goes into deciding what drug one is going to select.
So you've answered this in part, Joe, and it's one of the, or two of the questions that are already in the queue, but elaborate a little more on or an early intervention.
Yeah, so we know that the earlier you start there, obviously you have to feel comfortable that the patient has multiple sclerosis. And that's why the criteria we talked about earlier are so important. You don't want to be treating a patient that doesn't have multiple sclerosis with these drugs. They're costly and they have risks with them. And studies done at a number of institutions have demonstrated that the misdiagnosis rate with multiple sclerosis still remains at about 10 to 15%. But once you feel comfortable with that diagnosis, what's been clearly demonstrated is that the earlier you start treatment, the better patients do, and they don't seem to catch up if you start that treatment later. So finding that most appropriate treatment early is a key in treating patients with multiple sclerosis.
So, Anne, one of the questions is because I'm treating CIS.
Well, I treat it, if that's the question. If I'm convinced that the patient has clinically isolated demyelinating syndrome, then by all means, I would treat that patient because the data from a number of studies, as Joe said, have all pointed toward patients doing better with fewer relapses. And, you know, it's hard to get a long-term idea because you can't do a placebo-controlled trial for 20 years. But most of the database type information does indicate that patients do better when they're treated probably within a year of their onset.
Plus, there are 7 randomized controlled studies of CIS that all show there's a benefit to starting treatment at that point. So let's take a look at the timing of high efficacy disease modifying therapies, Joe.
Yeah, so clearly, the early initiation, as you've mentioned, of disease-modifying therapy alters the outcome in these patients. There's improved disease control and the long-term outcome. I've been practicing, as have both of you, for a long period of time, and there's been a difference in the prognosis of patients with multiple sclerosis now that these drugs are available. The frequency with which we see people go on to progressive disease, at least in my experience, and I haven't looked at it in a scientific fashion, has changed. The prior statistics were that 50% of patients with multiple sclerosis, relapsing remitting disease, would have progressive disease within 10 to 15 years of the onset. And I'm not seeing that. So I think we've made a big difference with the disease-modifying therapies we have. You reduce relapse rate, you reduce disability, you reduce the brain atrophy that's seen, and simply put, you keep people healthier. And in some instances, probably on a plateau. So I'm quite keen on making sure that we suppress disease activity in these patients.
Okay, so Anne, let's discuss the choices, the two main choices that clinicians think about when starting therapy.
Right, Fred. This is a big question for a lot of for us taking care of patients. I mean, it's either you're going to start with a highly efficacious but almost always higher risk agent and try to suppress disease as much as possible and monitor very carefully for safety, or you start out with a less risky but also probably less effective drug, such as one of the immunomodulators or teriflunomide. And then you monitor treatment response with MRIs and frequent clinical exams, and you move up the ladder if you run into problems with suboptimal response. So with both of these, there's pros and cons, obviously, and of course, take into account what my patients want, how they feel about risks and how they feel about jumping in with a high efficacy drug. Some people just won't do it. And of course, I look at their prognosis as much as I can, given that we can't really 100% prognosticate. But I look at the factors and I point out to them, I'm very honest with them about what their poor prognostic factors might be. And why I might recommend that they go on a high efficacy drug at the beginning versus a going the escalation approach. But it's ultimately, I think, a decision at least between the provider and the patient, if not the patient themselves. And they're the one that has to take it. So there's no easy answer to this question.
Good. So let's get our audience involved again. So here's your question. Well, immunomodulators dropped and cell trafficking picked up, cell depleting picked up. And I don't know, dropped dramatically. Okay. Anne, Joe, any thoughts about this?
Well, this is a young woman and we don't know what her concerns are. We're not sure whether she's planning on having a family, but there are certain drugs that I like to go to in individuals that are planning, females that are planning a family. So I don't think there's any wrong answer, to be honest with you, as long as you monitor the patient carefully. My sense is she has good prognostic features, and if she was anxious about some of the more aggressive therapies, I'd say an immunomodulator is perfectly fine. And if she wasn't, I would have no problem with a cell depleting agent or cell trafficking inhibition agent.
So one of our attendees has asked, does the presence of optic neuritis make a difference in choosing?
Not for me.
It's considered to be a good prognostic factor, but it's only one of so many, as we looked at in an earlier slide, and each one has a role. So these are just statistical things, and the patient may act differently than the statistics.
And so another member of the audience asked, does one poor prognostic factor mean that they have a poor prognosis?
I don't think you could say that.
No.
Right. And as you were saying at the start about the crystal ball, is that these are for groups, and that, in fact, prognosticating for individuals is very difficult.
That is so correct. Every time I've thought I knew the answer, I was wrong.
Well, I think the next case nicely illustrates the contrast in terms of the features that may be poor prognostic features.
Good point. So let's move on to the next case. This is Jason, a 46-year-old African-American male. He's a physician and is concerned because of his potential exposure to SARS-CoV-2. He has a tremor and incoordination that was first noticed 3 weeks earlier. He has paresthesias of both legs for the past 3 days, that lasted 3 days, 1 year earlier, and he has slight visual blurring in the left eye and urinary frequency and urgency. He was diagnosed with MS in 2018. He was started on interferon beta. His exam showed slow cognition, a pale left optic disc with a right afferent pupillary defect, bilateral gaze evoked horizontal nystagmus, a tremor of the right upper extremity with dysmetria on finger to nose and heel knee shin, and diffusely brisk reflexes and an abnormal tandem gait. And here we see his MRI findings, and I don't know how well that shows, but he's got a decent amount of lesion load on the top on the T2, including his brainstem, and he's got active disease shown by gadolinium-enhancing lesions in the bottom frame. So let's ask the audience now, how would you treat Jason? Remember, he's concerned about his exposure to COVID-19. So Joe, with many patients, clinicians being concerned about the ongoing pandemic, talk a little bit about the impact of COVID-19 on treatment paradigms for multiple sclerosis.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. And this, Fred, has been one of the chief reasons why we get phone calls in the office. There have been days where there have been 20 and 30 phone calls from our MS patients, and I'm sure at Mount Sinai and WashU, you had the same experience. Patients saying, oh my God, do I have to get off my drug? And it turns out that this particular disease, COVID-19, due to the SARS virus, the problem seems to be not so much the viral replication, but the immune effect that is triggered by it. So there's this hyperimmune response. And what we've found, although there have been a number of recommendations that have come out, a little hard evidence to support the recommendations. And what we seem to know currently is that people have done quite well on disease-modifying therapies. In fact, a couple of the disease-modifying therapies are now being used in clinical trials for the treatment of COVID because they affect the immune system in a salutary way. So the recommendations are for people to remain on their therapies. There are a couple drugs that you might consider not instituting. Alemtuzumab is one, since you get this profound lymphopenia and there's been concern about it. And cladribine is another, where there's a lymphopenia that occurs. But those individuals that have been on these drugs don't seem to have any higher risk of experiencing increased morbidity and mortality with COVID than anybody in the population. In fact, the people that have been hospitalized and have required ventilation with multiple sclerosis have by and large been older people with progressive disease on no disease modifying therapy and have multiple comorbidities. And that's the very same population minus the MS as the group that we're finding in the population at large, older people with comorbidities. The other thing that's interesting is, at least in our experience at Penn, we've not seen COVID-19 infections triggering MS relapse. We often think of viral disease triggering a relapse, but we've not seen that yet. So I think a lot of the concerns that people have had are probably unfounded.
Okay, so we think that Jason needs to switch his therapy. So, and a patient like Jason, sort of bad relapsing-remitting MS, you need to switch therapies. How do you handle the switch?
So he does have a number of poor prognostic indicators, and he's a physician, and he's worried about COVID. I agree with Joe. I've been following the COVIMS.org North American registry, and it's finding exactly what Joe just said. I think he did publish some of his cases out of Penn. Patients who are dying are the same people who are dying who don't have MS, older men with comorbidities. And so whereas the whole population in that registry is primarily women and they have recovered. So that being said, I don't think we have any hard evidence at all that any of these immunomodulators or immunosuppressive agents or whatever you want to call them that we use as DMTs in MS have a truly adverse effect on COVID-19 outcomes or on whether people even get COVID-19. So that said, I think with him, the real thing on the table in front of me is his MS. It's problematic. He's not responding to his present agent. So we need to find the best agent for him that he'll feel comfortable with. So I want to be honest with him about that and tell him that I think he needs a high efficacy drug. And then I would just go through all of these, the pros and the cons as I see them. And we look at all of his medications and his comorbidities and whether any of those would throw out some of the high efficacy medications that we would consider. And then we go from there and we monitor him, and he's careful. He works as a physician, so he's around patients. He has to be careful, but he should be smart enough to know how to be careful, and hopefully he won't get it. And if he does get COVID-19, he'll probably do okay.
Great, thank you. So let's ask the audience our final question. Okay, so immunomodulators went down, cell traffic inhibition went up, cell depleting therapies went up, and I don't knows went down. So, Joe, Ann, thoughts?
Well, I treated this patient, a very similar patient. It was at a time before the anti-CD20s were available, and I wanted to shut off the disease as quickly as I could. So he turned out to be JC virus antibody positive. Nonetheless, I started him on natalizumab with the understanding that in a year to a year and a half, I'd switch him to something else. That's precisely what we did. So I selected a cell depleting therapy, and I would have probably selected either natalizumab or an anti-CD20, probably an anti-CD20 because I know he's JC virus antibody positive. But we didn't have either the rituximab data or the availability of ocrelizumab at that time.
Anne, what do you think?
Well, before February or March of this year, I think I would have gone with a cell depleting therapy, most likely a B cell depleting agent, because they act quickly and very effectively, and patients do well with them. Now, you know, even though I just said that there's no data, and there is no data to say that those drugs are not, don't put people at more risk, there is certainly the thought that one might use something like natalizumab initially, because it is also very effective. And even if he is JC virus antibody positive, his risk of getting PML in the first couple of years is still fairly low. And then maybe we can get to the point where we have a vaccine that he can take, and then he could potentially at that point go on a B cell depleter or one of the other agents, such as oral cladribine. You know, I'm now thinking down the road a little bit about vaccines and when we're going to have a vaccine and what all these drugs are going to do to vaccine response. And, you know, we certainly don't know it for a SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. B cell depleters are probably not going to lead to a great response to most vaccinations.
So I was thinking about that as well. So we have data for many of the ages that they decrease the take of vaccines, but don't eliminate it. So they still get some take. I actually probably would have put him on myself on ocrelizumab. But one of the things that we're going to be looking at now is how well our patients, and we have lots of them now in New York City, how well they've mounted an immune response when they've had the infection. So you're looking at antibody levels, and that may give us some idea of how well they do when we do have a vaccine.
Yeah, that'll be very, very helpful information.
So I think today's discussion was very useful. And uncovered some areas where we may need to make some changes. So let me summarize the three actions that I'd like for our audience to take away. These are sort of SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, timely. So combine diagnostic features with prognosis as best one can to determine the therapeutic approach to relapse and remitting MS. Partner with the patients to discuss treatment goals to optimize outcomes. And Joe went through the various issues here. So it's very, very important to have the patient on board. And then integrate the most recent clinical data into the treatment paradigm of patients with relapse and remitting MS. And so we still have time to take your questions. I've got a bunch of them in the queue, but we can take more as well. So I'm going to go move over to the questions and start triaging them. And one I wanted to get to, let me see if I can find it here. Was okay, so we talked about early treatment of CIS, but what about RIS? What do you think about treating that?
So I have changed the way I look at RIS. I think RIS is really just a form of multiple sclerosis. And the data suggests that if you follow these people over time, they're going to become clinically symptomatic, at least a significant proportion of them. And therefore, I have started treating patients with RIS. That was not the case when it was first described, at least for myself. And there's data that I'm sure will be generated from the study of RIS that is underway. But I have generally treated patients that have RIS, particularly those that have CSF abnormalities, oligoclonal bands.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, this is a situation where you have to be really, really confident that your MRI looks like demyelination, that you're not miscalculating in its vascular lesions or something that doesn't fit into the demyelination paradigm. So I think getting a spinal tap and getting information from there, and if that's indicating an MS-like profile, then I would certainly recommend treating. If it doesn't, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, so I would agree with Anne. I mean, the only people that I treat are ones that I feel very confident have MRIs that are MS. Some of them have contrast-enhancing lesions generally have had elevated oligoclonal bands in the spinal fluid. So those people I have been treating. And I think that there are going to be some criteria coming out in the future, such as using T2 star and looking for the central vein sign in individuals, that is going to help us in distinguishing MRIs that are the consequence of microvascular disease and those that are the consequence of multiple sclerosis.
So while I agree with both of you, there are no data to support those recommendations.
Well, I didn't say it was a recommendation. You asked me what I did, not whether I recommended it.
Okay, so do as I do, don't do as I say, or
Something like that. Isn't that what you told your kid?
This is CME, so I just want to clarify that. And so someone's asking, why not include the optic nerve in criteria? And I will tell you that in the committee meeting, neuro-ophthalmologists made an impassioned plea to include it as a fifth site. And biologically, there are good reasons. However, the reason why it wasn't included, and Joe alluded to this issue of misdiagnosis, if you had the optic nerve, and let's take our first case, Julia. If she had an enhancing lesion in her optic nerve and one juxtacortical lesion, she would meet criteria for diagnosing multiple sclerosis. And we were worried that that was just too easy. And so that's why optic nerve wasn't included. Let's get to some other questions. Here's one. You have a patient, where did it go? It's in here. A patient on natalizumab for 5 years, still JC virus negative. Are you comfortable leaving the patient on the drug?
So the patient's on natalizumab, is that the question?
Yeah, natalizumab, 5 years, JC negative.
Yes, so I have patients that have been on natalizumab since it was reintroduced to the market and remain JC virus antibody negative. The risk of developing PML if you're JC virus antibody negative is probably on the order of 1 in 10,000. It's probably on the same order of somebody who is placed on fingolimod, where, by the way, the JC virus antibody test has not been validated as some mitigation risk strategy. I leave them on it. On the other hand, I try to get quarterly JC virus antibody tests on the patients on natalizumab. That is a big concern to me. So anytime they become positive, and I don't use the titer, once they become positive, they're positive in my mind, and I take them off the drug. But I still have patients that are rock steady, a negative on the drug for long periods of time.
Right, and you anticipated one of the questions here about the titer. So that's good. And in fact, I'll echo that. We've got people on it since 2006. And if they stay negative, there's really nothing else going on with them. They do very well.
I'll triple that.
Good. Let's go back to the RIS for a second. Since you discussed treating, what do you treat it with?
Well, I personally would not go with a very risky medication unless the MRI looks horrible and I'm a bad neurologist and not picking up the clinical signs that I should be picking up. But generally speaking, I am concerned about putting a patient at risk for a medication when they don't actually have a disease per se. So I tend to go with the lower risk agents, but still monitor them very closely for any progression or new clinical or initial clinical signs.
Okay, so we got lots of questions.
I do the same.
But we still have plenty of time, so keep sending them in. I'm sorry, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I do the very same thing, which is since they don't have a well-defined disease, I start with something that is safe and monitor them carefully. So I think that's a not unreasonable strategy.
Okay. And so if we start with a high efficacy agent, say a self-depleting agent, are there data that we can then de-escalate to see what happens?
So far, there has not been a study that I'm aware of. I have been in committee meetings discussing trying to do such a study. Maybe you two are aware of such a study, but I'm not. So this is a conundrum, and we're right now making decisions based on lack of evidence.
Right. I'm unaware of any studies that have looked at it. But then again, there are drugs that we use that in a way are time limited. So you put the patient on cladribine and, you know, it's not something that they're taking indefinitely. Or you put the patient on alemtuzumab and they're not taking it indefinitely. And one of my colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania, Amit Bar-Or, is very keen on studying whether you could take patients who have been placed on the anti-CD20s off the drug eventually. So there is that possibility that you might not need anything afterwards.
But that study hasn't been done yet.
No, I realize that.
So we do have some questions here. To that point is, and when can you stop therapy?
Sadly, I don't know that you ever can, unless maybe you're using alemtuzumab or oral cladribine and the patient is, or you've done a hematopoietic stem cell transplant and the patient is rock solid stable. But for most of our agents, I'm not sure that we can ever stop.
So we're studying.
I think for relapsing remitting disease, I agree with Anne. For the most part. However, there is a study that Dr. Corboy at the University of Colorado has designed and we're part of, you guys may be part of it as well, the PCORI study, which is where individuals who have been free of disease for a long period of time, that is both clinically and radiographically, and are older, have their therapy stopped. Now, that study hasn't read out yet, but there's been nobody calling and saying we're concerned because we're seeing increased disease activity now that in half the patients we've stopped the drug.
Yeah, that's the DISCO MS study. And it'll be interesting to say, and it's people 55 years of age and older.
Correct.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say we're in that study. And one thing I worry about with that study, which I've mentioned to John, is that people who want to go in it are people who have been stable for a long period of time, which is one of the requirements anyway, but
yeah,
you're not seeing people who are older who have even progression, but certainly not relapses or gaining new MRI activity in that study. So it's a very select group of people that would be taken off drug who have been stable for several years and aren't gaining new lesions off drug.
But it's a start.
Yeah, it's a start. Okay.
Let me go back to the IRS. So what's the time frame? Sort of how likely is a patient with radiologic isolated syndrome to develop symptoms? How long does it usually take?
If I recall the data, it's usually within a year or so that something will happen if you don't do anything.
Yeah, and there was 5 years, it was, I think, a third.
Third.
Yeah,
that was Darren Akuta's data. I think in 5 years, one third of individuals had clinical symptoms. But it wasn't the IRS. We're not talking about the IRS. We're talking about RIS. The IRS is the one that's going to call you after you file your taxes.
Did I say that backwards? Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So while we're on that, someone did ask about immune reconstitution. So that's another IRS. You want to talk about that, Joe?
Immune reconstitution, yes, sure. So this is a concern. This is an entity that was first described in HIV patients where you put them on antiretroviral drugs and one of two things happened. They either, if they had a disease like cryptococcal meningitis or PML, you saw this immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome where there was this robust inflammation that occurred at the site of the infection, and it could be the HIV alone to which you had an iris response. Or alternatively, you put the patient on antiretroviral therapy, not knowing that they had an opportunistic infection because it was inapparent and it blossomed. Now, that same term has been applied to the restoration of the immune system when you've taken people off drugs, like the individual who develops PML while on natalizumab. They can develop an iris as a consequence, very similar to this, what's seen in the HIV population when you put them on antiretroviral therapy. And it's a concern. I think that even this aggressive MS that we will sometimes see with certain agents, such as the S1P modulators and with natalizumab, when the drug is discontinued, in a way is an immune reconstitution. It's an immune reconstitution where the MS has just blossomed.
Okay. Another question in terms of the extended dosing of Tysabri. I want you to say a little bit more about that, Joe.
Yeah, so I was quite skeptical that this was going to be of any value, only because of what we know about the pathogenesis of PML. But it appears, at least from data generated by John Foley and others, that when you extend the dosing of Tysabri to 6 weeks or 8 weeks, that the risk of PML declines very substantially, and it still appears to suppress disease activity. Now, one of the problems with natalizumab is that the dosing is not based on weight. So if you look at the frequency with which PML is seen relative to the population, it's much less often in the United States than it is in Germany or Europe in general. And one of the thoughts is that we're just too damn fat. And we're actually giving much less natalizumab relative to body mass index or weight than people in other countries where the BMIs are less. That's a thought. There's some preliminary data to suggest that may be the case. We might be capable of driving the rates down with extended interval dosing, but I think you can eliminate the risk entirely in the JC virus antibody population by stopping the drug and starting another.
Okay, good. I have a question here. When is it indicated to do a bone marrow transplant? Anne, you want to take that?
I will. I don't know that it's ever indicated right now because we don't have true solid controlled data to support it, but there's certainly a lot of data using hematopoietic stem cell transplants in relapsing patients that suggests that it in some people can really halt the disease for long periods of time. The problem is we don't now have and probably will never have a great controlled randomized trial for this procedure, which is extremely expensive and north of 100,000 at least at our institution. There is a study that's about to get started, maybe it has already started, called BEAT-MS, which is going to look at this in more depth and try to do more of a controlled look at hematopoietic stem cell transplant.
But I think that the expense is offset when you look at what the expense of these drugs are. I mean, these drugs that we use are outrageously expensive. So it's not unusual for them to be $60,000 to $100,000 annually. So if we thought that hematopoietic stem cell transplantation was highly effective and safe, then you would eat that expense. And in response to your question, Fred, the population that I think merits stem cell transplantation is the MS patient with leukemia.
Oh, that's an easy one. That's good. Okay. Okay, so we have some folks in the audience who are primary care practitioners. And so they're asking, what are the signs and symptoms they need to look at and when to refer? So let me start on that. So anyone with neurologic symptoms or signs ought to get referred to a neurologist. The issue with multiple sclerosis is because it can affect any area of the central nervous system, it can produce any neurologic sign or symptom. The whole gamut, starting with vision and going down to numbness and tingling in the legs. Now, there's still a large differential diagnosis, but if someone's having neurologic symptoms, you know, then they need to be referred in to be looked at. And along those lines, and I'll throw this out to you two, there's a question of, and the RIS people, what else could be going on with them? What are the things that you see that make it not MS?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things that can cause DITSLs on the brain MRI that may or may not look like demyelination. I've even seen a person who had multifocal lymphoma who had ring-enhancing lesions that was initially thought to be MS, but that person had symptoms, so it was an RIS. But there are a lot of things that can cause CNS lesions in the white matter, in the corpus callosum even, primarily vascular, but also migraine. There are papers that list hundreds of differential diagnoses, but there are certainly people nowadays look for neuromyelitis optica, which doesn't usually look exactly like MS. And now we have a blood test that's reasonably sensitive to pick it up. And then anti-MOG, anti-myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein against the native myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein that's on the surface of cells. And that seems to be a separate entity, a separate disease from MS, but can look similar. So those would be two things to look for that might.
So what we talked a little bit about mistaken diagnosis earlier, and it turns out that the majority of individuals that are mistakenly diagnosed as having multiple sclerosis have been mistakenly diagnosed because of people rely too heavily on MRI. They looked at the MRI and they said, oh, you know what, this must be MS. Look at these lesions. And as Ann mentioned, there are many, many things that cause it. But if you take a population that's older, say 50 and above, and has comorbidities such as diabetes or hypercholesterolemia or hypertension, the frequency with which they have an absolutely normal brain is very, very small. I mean, we will always see one little thing or two little things or many little things. And sometimes we scratch our heads, even in young people, they come in, they have multiple white matter lesions, you have no idea what it is, no history of migraine, and you say, I don't know what this is, you were probably born with it. And it doesn't change over time. So from time to time, we just don't know.
Fair enough. Okay, this is an interesting one. The writer thought it was a little off topic, but it's actually a very good question. And that is, a patient who's on a disease-modifying therapy, in this case, teriflunomide, his grandparent and the grandkids are going to get their shots, MMR and HEP and all of those. Is there an issue for the grandparents to be around?
If they already have immunity and they're on teriflunomide, I think not. That's a drug that doesn't remove your old immunity. It doesn't kill off your cells. So I think they would be fine in that case, as far as I know. Certainly those patients have been given vaccinations in the past
So, Ann, would you recommend that they get their immunity checked for, say, MMR and for varicella?
Well, perhaps that might not be. But you're talking about these kids are getting vaccinated, correct?
Kids are getting vaccinated, but say, yeah. Varicella and MMR are live vaccines.
Right, they are. Well, perhaps it would be best to have the kids stay away from the grandparents. Maybe that wouldn't be so hard right now.
I can tell you it's unfortunate.
Yeah. You know, if these grandparents are the caregivers on a daily basis, it might not be a bad idea to check. I've actually checked this myself in patients who had this very same situation just to make sure. But I would say that sometimes people, and I've been told this from ID folks, people will have had, for example, the the childhood chickenpox vaccine, which we're too old to have had, but other people have had it, and they won't show that they have antibodies, even though they are supposedly immune. And of course, checking antibodies doesn't check the cell-mediated immunity that you get to these vaccines, so we wouldn't be able to check that very easily. All that said, I guess the safest thing would be to check.
Okay, let's get through some more questions here. Here's one that's someone working in the community said, what are the most efficient tools for measuring progression? So actually, I'm going to start with that. So it's not really the MRI, it's a clinical. If you want to really know about progression in progressive disease, it's the clinical exam and the symptoms of someone getting worse, usually by walking. We monitor MRI activity as well, but clinically is what you want to look at for progression. If you want to look at worsening, which could be either progression or stepwise worsening, then you can include the MRI. Unfortunately, and someone asked a related question, we really don't have data to say how much is enough to say it's time to switch. It's one of those things where we know it when we see it, but there's a large gray area.
So I'll just chime in and say that I find the history enormously helpful when I'm trying to determine whether somebody is progressing or not. Because sometimes the physical examination is indistinguishable from 1 6-month interval to the next. But when they tell me that they can no longer climb up a flight of stairs or two flights of stairs, or where previously they were able to walk 5 blocks, but now they're only walking 2 blocks, that's a pretty good indication that there's something going on. So, and that sort of reinforces what Fred just said.
Okay, so here's one. Lifestyle issues, diet, exercise, in addition to a disease-modifying therapy. How do you incorporate those into the treatment plan? Anne?
I always recommend that patients get enough exercise, and they may have to start low, and it may just be walking, but even just for bone density purposes, that's a good thing. If a patient is really obese, I try to bring that up in a gentle way and encourage them to work on that. And in some of my more obese people, I've recommended bariatric surgery or at least evaluation for that because their obesity is much more likely to kill them than their MS usually.
Let's get through a few more with rapid answers. So is MS always seen on a brain MRI without contrast? And take that as well.
I think so. If you have a good quality MRI and you've looked at the spinal cord and the brain and it's at least a 1.5 Tesla and you have non-gaps between your axial slices, I think, you know, it would be very, very uncommon to not see it on an MRI.
But the question was, is it always seen on the brain? And the answer is no.
Oh, okay.
Okay, that's fine. And how about pregnancy issues? Sort of quickly, does it affect your choice if people are planning pregnancy, say, down the road, a year or two?
Absolutely. It has a significant effect on how I'm going to treat them. And I generally default to glatiramer acetate in those that have good prognostic features. If I want to use a drug that is more highly efficacious, I typically select an anti-CD20. Like ocrelizumab, knowing that I can give them the drug, we can wait a few weeks after they've gotten the drug. The drug's gone, so it'll have no effect on the developing fetus. Its effect is on the B cells. And once they become pregnant, they're protected by the pregnancy.
And I think it's probably important to not use a drug that's associated with rebound when you stop. And that gets into one of the questions where someone had a flare coming off of fingolimod. So I think that would be of some importance as well. Here's one. Any interaction between disease-modifying therapies and medical cannabis or CBD?
Well, I'm unaware of it.
I'm not aware of it either. I did listen to a lecture recently about cannabis and about THC and CBD and the differences between the two and the many drug interactions they can have. So it wouldn't be surprising.
But I will say from a real world experience, because a significant number of my patients are taking cannabis in some form, I have yet to see one that's had some interaction with any of the drugs that they're on. So, you know, it may be something you could find in an article, but I'm not sure that it really makes a difference.
I agree. So we've had some questions concerning, again, about personal experience with COVID. You heard a little bit, but I think we could sum up and say, I think happily at this point, our general impression is that the patients with MS and on disease-modifying therapies have not shown more adverse events to COVID. And it's really the other risk factors for COVID that appear to be playing the major role in outcome. The issue of whether our therapies are helping by decreasing IL-6 is interesting. We don't have the data yet, but I suspect that we will in time. Let's see. Here's one more. Is there any evidence of lack of efficacy from any of the immunomodulators over time?
That probably goes more to changes in MS over time than to lack of efficacy, unless one has developed things like neutralizing antibodies to beta interferons or to natalizumab. But as the disease changes, sometimes there's decreased efficacy just due to a change to progression from relapsing. And none of our drugs work that well with progressive disease.
Okay, I think I'm going to have us finish up with a question on a topic we didn't talk about, which is genetics. It says, with a male patient, is there a risk of passing the disease on to his children, and is this a cause for any concerns?
So the data suggests that there are over 200 genes that contribute to the development of multiple sclerosis, but each contributes a very, very small amount. And we know that the risk, if you have a family member with MS, is increased amongst family members. And the closer the relationship, the greater the risk. So it may be 20 times for a first degree relative what it would be if you were unrelated. However, 20 times the population frequency, which is 1 in 700 to 1 in 1,000, means that you're talking about maybe a risk of 1 in 50. So it's not either autosomal dominant or autosomal recessive. It would still be a very small number of individuals in a family that would be affected. So I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. Obviously, if somebody were to develop neurologic symptoms, then it would raise concern. But even in identical twins, there's not a concordance.
Okay, well, we have a lot of questions. I'm sorry that I can't get to all of them, but your engagement has been extremely useful and the feedback has been outstanding. So I'm going to say thank you very much, Dr. Ann Cross and Dr. Joe Berger. Thank you all for joining us, and don't forget to collect your credit.